I'm Bob McDonald, and you're listening to Quirks and Quarks, the national science program heard every Saturday across Canada on CBC Radio 1, live on the internet at cbc.ca, and across North America on Sirius Satellite Radio 137. If you'd like to hear past programs that you may have missed, you can download them from our webpage at cbc.ca/quirks or subscribe to our weekly podcast. Coming up next, a lot of hot air on a very hot topic. By any measure, Canada's record on reducing greenhouse gas emissions has been, well, dismal. While we've signed treaties requiring us to cut our emissions, in fact, they've been doing nothing but going up, and going up fast. Despite the Made in Canada climate plans Prime Minister Harper was trumpeting at the UN summit in New York, few think our nation has an effective policy to reverse this disastrous trend. According to a new book by Dr. Mark Jackard, Canada's climate change plans have been just a lot of hot air. In fact, Hot Air, Meeting Canada's Climate Change Challenge, is the title of his book. In it, he and his co-authors examine what's gone wrong and what we should do to control our greenhouse gas emissions. Dr. Jackard is a professor in the School of Resource and Environmental Management at Simon Fraser University. Hi, welcome back to Quirks and Quarks.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with a hot button issue here. Now, you, like many members of our current government, think that Canada's Kyoto Protocol commitment is a mistake. Why do you feel that?
Well, I want to clarify that I'm a supporter of the Kyoto Protocol, but when I look at precisely what Canada did, we picked a target at Kyoto that was virtually unachievable, and certainly unachievable if we did not implement policies of a compulsory nature right off the bat. Our government picked an almost inachievable target and then did nothing of note to reduce emissions. My colleagues in Australia, for example, did research, were directed to do research by their government to look at how difficult it would be in Australia. Australia went to Kyoto and was able to negotiate a target that their emissions would be 8% above 1990 levels by the year 2010. Canada went to Kyoto, and without doing any of that analysis, the government didn't ask any of us to do that kind of analysis, and picked a number largely based on hopes and aspirations, as far as I can tell. And that was for a 6% reduction from 1990 levels by 2010.
So how much above that target are we going to be when that deadline comes?
Our emissions will be 25 to 30% higher in 2010 than they were in 1990. And remember, we've said we want to be 6% below that 1990 level. So that's the path we're on right now.
Do you think there's any chance that we'll actually meet the Kyoto targets at some point?
Well, when we say at some point, the Kyoto targets are targets for reductions at a certain period in time, you know, the year 2010 or the average from 2008 to 2012. And we definitely won't reach those in that time frame. Can we get our emissions down to the Kyoto levels and below in a decent time frame? And my answer to that is I'm quite confident that we can if we put the right policies in place over the span of the next few decades, we could get those emissions down to very low levels. The technologies are already there.
Well, have we done anything so far since Kyoto? Have we done anything to reduce our emissions?
We've mostly done things like, so on a policy sense, we've used information programs, advertisements, labels on appliances, a Rick Mercer commercial. We've used some subsidies. But when you give someone a subsidy to better insulate their house, you don't actually control what size house they end up with at the end of that. They're doing renovations. Is it a larger house? If you give them a subsidy to get a more efficient fridge, you don't know if the old fridge ends up in the basement, or they eventually buy a water cooler and a wine cooler and all these other products that people are acquiring. So the policies were terribly flawed. In terms of actions, Canadians have gone on doing what they've done for decades. Some of them buy more efficient products and devices. Some of them buy less efficient, but growth goes up continuously. So I would say, no, we haven't done much at all. We're really at the baby step stages still. And for me, that's after two decades, which is why I wrote this book.
Well, if you say the government has failed then in its policies, where do the individuals come in here? And can't individuals take responsibility and say, okay, I'm going to buy solar panels or I'm going to be more environmentally conscious?
And I think that's important. I think it's important that individuals try to see what they can do. But I would give the example of let's say speeding in our cars in school zones. Would we expect our politicians to say to us, listen, it seems that many of you now in opinion polls don't want people to speed in your cars in school zones. And therefore, we're now doing advertising campaigns and we're going to put up signs that tell people, you know, not to speed and maybe even things that tell them what speed they're going. But we're not going to have any fines for speeding and we're not going to take people's licenses away if they're repeat offenders or anything like that. We're just going to, you know, ask people to try to do that. At the end of the day, if we want greenhouse gases to go down, we have to oblige everybody to face the real costs of them emitting greenhouse gases. We have to have a price on those emissions, and that would be very similar to our school zone policies. We have to have some compulsoriness in those policies. People acting on their own, some people will do that. It won't be enough, and we know that.
So how do you enforce that? How do you see it working?
Well, the way you would do it is either have something like a carbon tax or what's called a regulated cap on emissions. It says, here's the total amount of emissions you can have in your country or in an industrial sector or whatever. And you may give out permits to people that add up to the permits to emit that add up to that total amount. And then the total amount of permits handed out decline over time so that emissions would fall over time. Or you put in this carbon tax that rises over time. Now, politicians are finally starting to talk about this a little bit. So we've got the government of Quebec has brought in what it calls a carbon tax. But what I also want to say is, so now that the right policies are being talked about, they can still be done incorrectly. And so far, the government of Quebec has said, oh, we're putting in this carbon tax, but we don't want the prices for consumers, for the energy products that they consume that emit greenhouse gases. We don't want those prices to go up. We want producers to swallow the carbon tax. And in fact, that's not what you want. You want prices to start reflecting how much you emit. Otherwise, those changes don't occur, just like you want to fine people for speeding in school zones. Likewise, we talk about this policy that the federal government is now dealing with where they want to put in a policy to regulate emissions by large industry. But the policy proposals that I've seen have too much of what I call loopholes, which essentially say to industry, actually, you don't need to reduce your emissions as long as you subsidize someone else to do what looks like they're reducing emissions. I don't know what that'll be, planting trees, again, putting insulation in their house. But those kind of subsidy programs are subject to all the same flaws that I was just talking about. So we're heading in the right direction for the right kinds of policies, but you can still botch it in how you implement them. And that, again, with the writing of the book, we're trying to wave this flag for people. There's still this huge danger out there.
There's a point you brought up in the book that was kind of surprising, and that is the idea that people think, well, if I can just be efficient in my energy use and reduce consumption, that should be enough. That maybe that could take us off fossil fuels just by going with it. And you're saying no, that efficiency and reducing consumption is not the answer to climate change.
Yeah, I would say that they are are a significant part of the answer. But I think, again, that it's a real mistake for us to focus there uniquely. And the other thing is, though, just talking about energy efficiency, if you just do some calculations sort of at a global scale, in Canada, we might use 300 gigajoules a year per person. So gigajoules, just some number. It doesn't matter. 300, typical Canadian energy use. Someone in India uses about one. So 1/300th of what we use. So if you just do the numbers of a growing global population, if you have those people using, even part of the energy we use to improve their lives for medical services and communications and home conveniences, then the amount of energy used on the planet will be enormous. It'll grow 2 or 3 times what it is today. So we need to have zero emission forms of energy, whether that's renewables, nuclear power, or using fossil fuels but capturing the carbon dioxide. So energy efficiency alone won't do it. And I've even become convinced that even when you put in the right policies I'm talking about, Canadians will still end up using a lot of energy. Because when I even try to, in a computer model that I use that runs the energy economy system, and I try to simulate a higher tax on, well, the energy products that consume, that produce greenhouse gas emissions, I still find that people use a lot of energy. They do switch to cleaner processes. They do adopt more efficiency than they otherwise would have. And yet their total energy demand does not fall significantly. It, you know, it gets offset by these other things that we want to have: backyard patio heaters, driveway de-icers, roof de-icers, massage chairs. It goes on and on.
Okay, well, then let's look to the future. That's the, we've been talking about the problems here. Our government's looking at what they call a Made in Canada solution. They've announced a policy that includes cuts of 20% emissions by 2020 and greater cuts beyond that. Now, what's your take on that?
Our government has, our federal government, and but a lot of provincial governments are doing this too, has set new targets. And remember, part of our book is we talk about the litany of past targets that didn't have policies to achieve them. And it's early innings, but unfortunately, I still see us on the same path. There hasn't been the transparency that would allow those of us who are independent researchers, people that I collaborate with around the world, to be able to look at, okay, what assumptions did you make about how people would uptake those energy-efficient devices and so on, given the policy tools that you were implementing? So it's a, there's a real research science to this. If I bring in my colleagues internationally to look at the Canadian situation, they would still be very dubious about what those policies are and what they will achieve.
So say we put a price on carbon, as you suggested, how do we know this will actually work to reduce the emissions?
This is because price or regulation is how we've addressed other environmental issues. So if we look now at what would happen if a carbon tax were implemented, some people panic and say, well, that means the cost of driving my car is going to skyrocket. And so how can I possibly, you know, I kind of want to help the climate, but that sounds horrendous. I have to get to work. I've got to get the kids to school and so on. But actually, that's not how it would, it would not impact people in the draconian way that some people imagine. First of all, you put the tax on at modest levels, but you set a schedule for how it's going to climb over the next 10, 15, 20 years. This provides a signal to people when they're buying cars about the choice they make, and it provides a signal to manufacturers about which cars to favor. And so what it means is that manufacturers start seeing, yes, some people are still going to buy gasoline-driven internal combustion engine cars, but we better make sure we've got a lot of hybrid cars out there, which also use an internal combustion gasoline-driven engine, but are using regenerative braking, the energy from braking the car and so on. We better start looking at more cars driven by biofuels. That could be biodiesel or ethanol that that we hear about, and ultimately hydrogen-driven fuel cell cars. And so manufacturers are realizing, the writing's on the wall. If we don't want to get left behind, we better start making these kinds of vehicles, because an incrementally growing percentage of people buying new vehicles will start to opt for these other ones. These are the, I'm giving that as an example of the automobile because that's immediate to most people. It also means that the costs, though, of these other technologies, which today are more expensive, do not climb. It's only the cost of the technologies that have greenhouse gas emissions going out your tailpipe that rises in cost, but not the others. So when we do a computer model like I run of the whole economy and show people slowly switching over to these other technologies, their costs don't skyrocket for taking the kids to school and getting to work. Their costs edge up a little bit, but not in ways that would seem dramatic to people, even compared to, let's say, the gasoline price increases that we've had in the last few years. The kinds of things that I'm talking about that would lead to significant reductions over the next 2 to 3 decades would involve energy cost increases, so bill increases of less than 1% per year over a 20-year time frame. So let's call it 1% per year. So that would mean that 20 years from now, your energy bill might be 20, 22, 24% higher than it is today. I mean, we just need to honestly tell people that's what it's going to cost you to get those emissions down. And when you show that to people, and I've seen some surveys in the United States and Canada, that kind of trade-off, they're willing to make it.
Is there anyone who has tried a carbon tax in any other country and had it work?
Well, this is interesting as well, is because as someone who does a lot of work internationally, I have colleagues around the world, and it's fun when they ask me to come to Europe to give a talk. I realize I have to change my talk entirely. Because when I'm in England, for example, in the United Kingdom, the United Kingdom has a carbon tax. It's had it for years. Norway, who is an oil and gas exporter like Canada, has had a carbon tax since 1991. Norwegians are now leaders in how to use fossil fuels without emitting greenhouse gases, like the development of carbon capture and storage, burying it deep in the sedimentary aquifers. These policies had a real effect, and it's all obvious now.
It almost sounds like painless here. Too good to be true, is it?
If we start telling ourselves the truth about the research evidence out there, about the kinds of policies that are needed, and start pushing our politicians to, you know, a movement for a carbon tax, those people who really care about the climate should be calling for that. If we get those in place and design them properly so that they're truly effective, but that they don't destroy the economy and they don't destroy our competitiveness internationally, then I think it wouldn't be that difficult over the span of the next couple of decades to make dramatic inroads in getting our greenhouse gas emissions down.
Dr. Jacquard, thank you very much.
It's been my pleasure.
Dr. Mark Jacquard is an environmental economist at Simon Fraser University. His book, Hot Air, written with Jeffrey Simpson and Nick Rivers, is published by McClellan and Stewart.